I'll just say the thing, and if it's not true, well, you won't be able to find out on Wikipedia, so you're going to have to dig a little deeper than that. Welcome to episode 6 of Active Heart.
Will you make an assertion? Do you want me to hum the Hallelujah chorus? Will that make it better?
I don't get it. The Hallelujah chorus. I don't understand. You're making a joke that I don't get.
Oh, we'll get to it.
Okay.
Or maybe it's not a good joke. I don't
know. The 6th and final episode of Active Heart, corresponding to the 6th and final episode of Gunbuster Aim for the Top. Sorry if we seem a little bit off at the moment. It's because we've just watched the last episode of Gunbuster, and, well, it has an effect on a body, doesn't it, Molly Ann?
It does. It's got us feeling some type of way.
So this episode just plunges right in to it just puts the pedal down on, like, the feelings mobile, and it does not let up the whole time.
I think I wrote this in my notes, like, 5 minutes in or something.
Mm-hmm.
But the first, like, 5-10 minutes of this episode is truly an onslaught of not only emotional information, but just information.
Right, so the episode opens with a giant caption, 15 years later.
What sad things could have possibly happened in 15 years?
Right, so we see an older post short haircut Amano.
Rip Amano's beautiful hair.
Yes, rip in peace, Amano's beautiful hair. Also, rip in peace, her husband, Coach.
Also, I'm sorry, but at this point, I can't not call her Amano.
It's fine.
Her last name is no longer Amano. She is now Kazumi Ota, but I'm not going to call her that.
It's fine. Buddy, you've got like a I'm going to cause trouble look in your face. I'm talking to my cat. And I think he's going to cause trouble. So, Coach is dead. Amano has aged 15 years, along with the rest of the Earth, because it's 15 years later. And she's preparing to go back into space. Oh, also, it's in black and white.
Yeah.
Everything is in black and white. The entire episode is in black and white. And this is the assertion I was about to make, which is this episode was way over schedule and over budget. And one of the consequences of that, I seem to remember hearing but cannot currently find a citation for, is that it is shot in black and white because it is all they could afford.
Mm.
Which makes more sense to me than it was just like animated in black and white. Like, I'll bet it makes sense to me that it was animated, like the cells were painted in color, and then they couldn't afford to shoot it, so they had to find a cheaper way to shoot the film, and so they shot it in black and white, is my understanding.
God, can you imagine?
Because I don't think that painting it in black and white would actually be any less work.
Can you imagine how, like, there's, what would it be like to own a Gunbuster Episode 6 cell?
I mean, they must be out there, and they must be in color. That
would be insane.
That would be truly insane. If you have a Gunbuster Episode 6 animation cell, please contact us and send us a picture of it, because we would love to see. That said, I think it works. I think it's great.
Yeah, I'm fine with it.
I think it's perfect. I wouldn't change a thing.
No. This is a running theme for me. And if a thing doesn't go the way it's supposed to go in an Anno show, I still wouldn't change a thing.
Yes.
It ends. Amano is not alone for long, though.
No.
Because then she is joined by her teenage students who call her... She's Coach Ota.
Yeah, she's Coach Ota.
We were like, Kashiwara is now like the hot, hard femme coach descendant. No, actually, Kashiwara is now the principal of the school.
Yes.
This is the head bully from episode 1.
Like, she was the hard-ass coach for a while. Now she's the principal of the girls' mecha school, and Amano is the coach of the robotic of the mecha portion.
Yeah. And what among her students is Kimiko's daughter, Takami.
Takami-chan, yes.
Who's now like a senior in high school.
And it just seems, you pointed out that it just seems like they just straight up reused her character model for her daughter, which...
It's like, wow, hairstyles really haven't changed in 10, 15 years.
Also the same voice actress, but it's very cute.
No, one difference. She doesn't have glasses.
Okay.
Yeah, so...
That's something.
That's how you know they're different people. And Kashiwara is like, are you really going into space again? And then says something like, space is a strange place. And it's like, yeah, it fucking is.
Yeah, it's real weird.
It might be better to talk about this in a couple minutes, but this is a thing that totally passed me by in my first viewing.
Mm-hmm.
How effective just the disorientation of the beginning of this episode is.
Yes.
Like, we left the last episode, which was a very sad, like, mostly like character moment episode, but nonetheless ended in a really big victory for humanity. That's right. Not like the vibe.
Not at all.
At the beginning of this episode, but we're not given the lead up to that. We're just plunged into this world that has clearly changed a lot.
Right.
Where the threat is very active.
Yes.
Technology is progressing. The space monsters are still a threat.
Right.
But nonetheless, Kashiwara is like, are you sure you want to go? Like, you're one of the heroes of the...
The battle of the...
Absolute defense.
Of the absolute defense line.
Yeah.
Oh, and there's an interesting moment there when Amano says, you know, I wasn't the hero there. Like, I wouldn't have been able to do anything if Noriko hadn't snapped me out of it. Like, she's the only one. She's the real hero.
Yeah.
Which is interesting to see her just totally giving credit to Noriko, which, like, deservedly, but, I mean, rather, like, Noriko deserves a lot of the credit there, but Amano is like, oh, I didn't do anything, which also isn't true.
I do think, you know, I don't think it's in Amano's character to, no matter what she did, I couldn't see her as, like, a bragger.
No, not at all.
But what's interesting about that conversation is that, you know, Noriko's not in this scene.
And we don't know where she is.
Amano is such a polite, classy woman.
Yeah.
Like, you could see her saying this no matter what happened.
Yeah.
But we kind of know, like, the actual emotional weight of how true that is for her.
Yeah.
And
so she goes to Hawaii, which is...
a really interesting, like, logistic...
She goes to Hawaii, which is like Hawaii, and then it gives a caption like, no damage sustained, which is a strange caption because it sort of implies somehow that there are other places on Earth where damage has been sustained. Damage of what sort, we don't really know. It isn't explained. The caption comes up and goes away, and then she gets on the orbital ropeway, which is like a ski lift that takes you to space.
But it still has subway ads in it, which is cute.
It's very funny. I love space elevators and space ropeways, which the latter of which truly don't make any sense. But one of the things that I love about them is that when we talk about them, we often forget, and Gunbuster extremely commits this crime, that a journey on a space elevator or a space ski lift like this would take weeks. Because you're going up there at, like, kind of a normal speed.
Yeah.
But you're going, you know, if you're going up to geostationary orbit, which is like an orbit where that stays over the same spot of the Earth all the time.
Yeah, and
that's like 20...
The space station.
That's like 25,000 miles out. So, like, that's a long trip that you're just kind of going up at, like, normal ski lift speed. So you're in that thing for, like, 3 weeks. Which they're clearly not in that thing for 3 weeks. The indication is that she gets in the orbital ropeway, and like half an hour later, she's in space.
Night on the galactic ropeway.
And she has a really...
That's the name of this episode.
She has a really interesting conversation with, like, a guy. Like, the sort of attaché that's sent to escort her to the space station.
This is like the spiritual successor to that one guy in the Excelion meeting that's like, do humans serve a purpose?
Yes. So she's going up to take command of the Buster Machine Unit 3.
Which is also known as the Black Hole Bomb.
Which is known as the Black Hole Bomb, we're told. And escort it to where the bulk of the fleet is to actually deploy it. And the guy says, on the ropeway, he outlines the plan, which is basically take this thing to where the space monster's nest is, the region of the galaxy, like the central region of the galaxy where they're most dense, and blow it up, obliterating most of the Milky Way.
They also say the space monster's entire home world.
Right. But like, it's like the most of the central, like most of the Milky Way is going to be destroyed in the detonation they're expecting from the black hole bomb. And he says, man, does mankind really have the right to destroy an entire galaxy? Which is an extremely reasonable question to be asking.
An ominous sort of, like upon boarding the space ropeway, Amino immediately puts on her sort of military demeanor.
Yes.
But during this conversation, she drops it and laughs a little bit and says, like, to be honest, I don't know either.
Yeah.
But what is, we are humans, what's our choice? Like, our other choice is suicide.
Yeah, annihilation. And we're not going to do that. So I guess we're going to blow up most of the Milky Way.
Like, what? Maybe I... She has something like, all we're doing right now is surviving at all costs.
Yeah. And that's the last time the ethics of the plan are ever discussed. And it's interesting because it feels like it's a foregone conclusion that, like, life on Earth and the space monsters are the only two types of life in the galaxy. And it comes down to a very, well, it's us or them kind of choice. And that's an interesting scenario to have set up, but I don't know.
This is not as good of a show.
Yeah.
As good of a work.
Yeah.
It's originally a manga as Gunbuster. But one thing I do like about Tsutomu Nihei's Knights of Cydonia is that it has a little bit of this. Where, I mean, it's a really brutal work of science fiction. Mm-hmm. Like, even the world for humans is incredibly brutal, but it has this kind of setup where it's like a human race that has migrated to space, and they're fighting space monsters that, like, sort of like Gunbuster space monsters are, like, incomprehensibly large.
Okay.
And just so unlike humans that you cannot possibly, like, understand what their aim is.
Sure.
But there's a little more of, like, interacting with them and, like, what purpose do they serve in the galaxy? And so I think that is a really interesting question. But I'm fine with it, you know, not being, like, a question we answer in Gunbuster.
Yeah.
Because Gunbuster is an incredibly human story.
Yes.
It's a human work. Sorry. A Human Work is the episode title of episode 7 of Evangelion. Also the title of my blog. Also, I think at some point on the space ropeway, they pass over Australia.
Yes.
And they observe that, like, there is damage to this region.
Right. And it's not clear, like, is the damage from space monsters attacking, or is it something else? Is it, like, some kind of environmental disaster? They don't say, and we don't know.
But at this point, I was still trying to get my bearings.
Yeah.
I think as anyone watching this episode is, on what the context is in the world now. So my initial thought was, like, did something about the operation that Noriko and Amino succeed in the last episode, like, did that still result in some damage to Earth?
Right.
Or has there just kind of been this ongoing battle with the space monsters in the last 15 years that we're not getting filled in on.
Right.
And then we
cut to Noriko.
And they're on the Eltrium now.
The Eltrium.
Which is the
ship that was under construction
in the last episode. The last-ditch human extinction.
Yeah.
Not human extinction. Human, like, escape ship.
Right.
Which,
obviously hasn't been used for that.
Yeah, hopefully. It's been recommissioned for something else. Captain...
Same guy.
I can't remember his last name. He's still around. Yeah, the captain of the Excellion is the captain of the Eltrium.
Yeah.
And Noriko has long hair now.
Like, longer hair.
And it's initially unclear, like, how much
it's time not clear if 15 years has passed for her or some other period of time has passed for her. She's out serving as the co-pilot of Gunbuster with young Freud.
Who also, like, looks more or less
the same. Yeah, so it's not clear. And they're near the core of the galaxy, sort of at the leading edge of the war against the space monsters. And we get the sense that they've been kind of fighting skirmishes against the space monsters for the past some amount of time.
Also, technology just looks a little different.
Yeah.
The Eltrium now.
The Eltrium is clearly like a more advanced warship. There's this cool like hollow disc that Noriko steps on to like take her into the center of the bridge. Hollow disc, like hover disc.
And you also get the sense that communication between the Eltrium and Earth is not good,
or
not
maybe
good, like, or not possible,
barely possible at all.
Because they know that that Gunbuster Unit 3 is being brought in for right. this huge operation,
and they know that Amino is coming.
They don't know.
Yeah.
Because Noriko's like, I wonder who could...
Oh, that's right. Yeah, Noriko's like,
who's at the helm of this.
Yeah, so there's the communication between them is very sporadic and low content. And then they get the signal that warp is coming in, and the Buster Machine number 3 warps in, and it's gigantic.
Yeah.
It's a gigantic black egg-shaped object.
So the Gunbuster was sort of like huge... to a similar size as the Excellion.
Yeah.
The Gunbuster 3 black hole bomb is like...
it's like on a planetary scale.
Yeah.
It's like the Death Star.
The Eltrium is like tiny compared to it.
It is like, it is vast. And the captain of the Eltrium is shot like...
yeah,
he's like terrified. He's like, my God, has humanity's like mastery of science progressed so far in only 15 years?
And that's when we're both like, okay... now we understand, like, how time has worked for them.
Right.
Also, like, their communication's not great.
Right.
And kind of similar to the end of episode 2,
mm-hmm.
when Amino and Noriko encounter the Luxion.
Yeah.
And they come back to the Excellion, like, launch party.
Right.
The door opens, everyone's already there, and it's Amino that steps in.
Yes. Oh, that's a good point.
She's very formal, but then, like, when she sees Noriko, she just rushes to her and is overjoyed.
Yes.
And also when she's like manning the Gunbuster 3 to start the warp, she says to herself, like, I'll finally get to see her again.
Yes.
And Noriko is kind of dumbfounded. Like, she doesn't like rush into her arms or anything.
No, she's really taken aback and doesn't know what to think, because Amino is 15 years older than the last time she's seen her. And then in the next scene, when they have a conversation and catch up, we learn that only 6 months has passed for Noriko and the crew of the Eltrium and the fleet that's been out
in the center of the galaxy. We're in Noriko's room on the Eltrium, and we get this pan over her wall, and she has the picture of her and her father when she was a little kid.
Yeah.
Like the very first shot of the entire show, that picture. We have her high school graduation photo where she's kind of awkwardly pasted in. And then we have Amino and Coach's wedding photo.
Oh, yeah.
Which was like a couple weeks ago for her.
Yeah.
Or a couple months ago. And it, like, Amino, you can't see it super clearly, but Amino still has like long hair, is like 18 or 19 years old in this picture.
Mm-hmm.
And that really hammers in, like, she just saw this person.
Yeah, like,
as, like, a late teen.
A few months ago. And now she shows up again and she's, like, 35.
I think she's 32.
Yeah.
Which is, how old, I think, canonically, how old Coach is physically for the whole show.
Mm.
Which is kind of weird to think about.
Yeah.
Also, Noriko still has her Ghibli. She brought her Ghibli poster.
Oh, she has all kinds of, like, anime posters on her wall in her room. And, like, in the background, all these SF fanzines are stacked up. Like, she's a gigantic, like, science fiction and anime fan.
And you kind of wonder...
per the interior of her room.
You wonder, like, has she always been this way? She must have been. But, like, the last time we saw a shot of her room... she was on Earth with all these Excellion branded boxes that she hadn't unpacked. And it's like, this shit must have been in those boxes.
Yeah.
And it's this nice little moment of, I feel like what it signals is that for all her loneliness and displacement, like, space is ultimately the place where she feels like she can, like, unpack and make a home.
Yeah. I mean, you get the sense of how little time she's had in any one place ever since graduating high school, basically.
And her demeanor is basically the same.
Yeah. Like, she seems a little bit more... a little more reserved, a little more battle-hardened, and a little bit, like... Amano makes these overtures of, like, emotional intimacy, and Noriko returns them, like... only kind of half-heartedly or hesitantly because she just doesn't know what to make of her friend showing up, like, old.
Yeah. And this is also, like...
or rather, like, I say because. The causality is not clear. But she's taken aback in a way that she doesn't feel free to just come out and say, like, wow, it's weird that you are 15 years older and have, like you just buried Coach after, like... a decade plus of married life with him, and okay. you are a different person, and I'm the same person, basically, and I don't know what to do with this.
I think it's really tragic.
It is tragic.
On two levels. From Noriko's perspective, in the last episode, we had her go through the exact same thing, running into Kimiko, who is, you know, now 27 years old and has a child.
Yeah.
But at least... you know, like, Amano was with her also as sort of a displaced teenager when that happened. Now, two times she's had to, like, encounter her closest friends older. And we've talked so much about Noriko being lonely, and both of her closest friends at this point have had, like, a form of adult intimacy that she hasn't experienced.
Yes.
Like, Kimiko is married with a child. Yes. Amano has been married. It's also really sad for Amano, because Amano comes back and all of her classmates, like Noriko, are also 10 years older.
Yes.
Now she's, like, going back to meet, like, young... she's been, like, double...
yes.
Like, time fucked here.
It's... time dilation has wreaked absolute havoc on the life path of both Amano and Noriko, but particularly Noriko has basically been removed from the flow of time.
Yeah.
Like, entirely.
And we remember how last episode ended, where...
she has become unstuck in time. You don't get that because you haven't seen Babylon 5, but also, and that in turn is a reference to... famous literary fiction authors, Slaughterhouse
Five. Kurt Vonnegut?
Kurt Vonnegut's Slaughterhouse Five, but unstuck in time. She is unstuck in time.
I also get the sense
that it's horrifying. Go on.
Like, we ended the last episode with Amano kind of finding her place, at least temporarily, with Coach, and Noriko realizing that she doesn't have anyone. And this profound loneliness of Noriko, but now, after all these years have passed, I feel like Amino has sort of like realized she's in the same position. It's just caught up to her later.
Yeah.
And she's so desperate for that intimacy.
We haven't seen Amino be emotionally vulnerable or like open in the way she is with Noriko, but she's like
needy.
She's immediately just like, oh my God, it's so good to see you. Like, she's just like, needy is not a bad word. Like, she's just really wants to like just pick up their friendship right back where it started.
But it's like, it's weird because Noriko, you know, 6 months in, it's possible that she's still kind of emotionally processing this realization after Amino and Coach finally got together.
Yes.
That she doesn't really have like a number one person. Amino has lived like a whole other life.
Yeah.
Where she's now coming back to the realization that Noriko is like
the only person that can share her experience.
And, you know, has always, at this point, has always been one of the most important people in her life.
Mm-hmm.
And the next scene, they're preparing for the operation.
And there's no time for these feelings, because it's like, the Buster Unit 3 is here, we're at the edge of the center of the galaxy, we have to set it off right now.
There's a little bit of time for them all to be in their bras again, getting ready. So.
Yes.
Which is also a really nice scene, because it's like, I don't know, like, Noriko and Freud are just psyching themselves up in the mirror. Freud is like checking her earrings or something.
Yeah.
Amino like holds up her hand and like looks at her wedding ring.
Yeah. It's interesting. It's an interesting moment. And then young Freud gives Amino the key to the other half of the Gunbuster.
After giving her one last slap across
the face. After slapping her and saying, like, well, you got Coach and the Gunbuster, so I guess you're two for two, or whatever. Noriko does not, or rather, Amino does not slap her back.
No.
She just takes it, and the key, and I guess the Buster Unit 3 will go out autonomously, so that Noriko and Amino can pilot the Gunbuster together.
And she gets in, and Noriko's like, what?
Yeah.
Yeah. And this is when stuff gets real, like, Amino.
Stuff gets real weird. So, like, they go out, they set off the black hole bomb.
I'm sorry that I'm using Amino as a word for just, like, budget hijinks.
Yeah, like, so they go out, they set off the bomb. The bomb fails to go off because the alien fleet is attacked and caused just enough damage to the black hole bomb to cause a small fraction of its like degeneracy reactor colliders.
You're skipping so much.
No, I'm not.
Okay.
That this is all what happens.
Go on.
Right?
Go on.
Am I wrong? No, I'm not skipping that much. And if I'm skipping anything, I'm doing so in the exact same spirit of the episode.
Okay, go, Paul.
Well, no, I'm sorry. I take it back. The alien fleet shows up, and then you're right. You're so right. The alien fleet shows up, and then the captain is like, "We have to hold them off for 12 minutes while the bomb powers up." And then there is an extremely, like, there's a slideshow of storyboard art, essentially
set to Handel's Messiah,
like a real MIDI ass cover of Handel's Messiah.
Okay, this is why I was like, well, you make an assertion, do you want me to like hum the Hallelujah chorus to make it sound cooler?
Yes,
that's why I said that at the beginning.
Oh, I see.
There's at least at one point there's at least like the leitmotif of like, and he will reign for which is the music that is playing when Kaoru is killed.
Oh, I see.
But like in Ava, it's like full blast.
Yes.
This it's used in a less overt way, but
honestly,
I want the oral history of like when did Hideaki Anno like imprint on this piece of music?
Yes. So like clearly they ran out of money for this battle. So they did not animate it, and it's just like a montage of like sketches and like storyboard art wherein the space fleet desperately tries to hold off the alien attack. So the bomb can have time to power up. And then it's over and we get like a breakdown of casualties.
There's some
real
cool,
quick.
Like, there's some cool shots of like what it would have been, because like they make sure to let you know like who's in the battle.
Oh yeah, no.
There's a couple cool.
Would have been a real fucking cool scene.
Young Freud like battle screaming, so it's like that probably was like.
Yeah, and Young Freud is in the Sizzler Black, like the production model of the Gunbuster mech.
And it's, I forgot to write down the actual numbers, but it's like lots of casualties. The numbers involved in this battle are just really fucking big.
Yes.
Like, on a scale that we haven't seen before.
A lot of ships and a lot of space monsters have both been destroyed, but all three Gunbuster units are intact. The black hole bomb is intact. Its defenses have not been breached. And the Gunbuster itself is fully operational.
And then the captain's like, "What? Like, who is left aside from us?" And it's like 2,000 something.
It's like 2,000 odd ships, which is a small fraction of the
fleet. Yeah, this was compared to like
20,000 or something.
Either casualties or like heavily damaged ships was like in the 22,000 or something. Yeah. Also, the battle language in this episode is really interesting.
Okay.
It's not... So we have that conversation on the space ropeway.
Yeah.
About the ethics of this fight and how it's like, well, all we're doing now is surviving at all costs. There's not... In a lot of... anime, movies, novels, whatever, anything sci-fi realistic that involve military operations, there's a lot of bravado kind of talk.
Yes.
There's like hypey pep talks.
Yeah.
That's not in this. Like the language about this battle is, it's both religious and kind of humbled.
There's a back and forth conversation that we return to several times between the captain and maybe his first officer, where the captain asks the first officer, "Do you believe in God?" And the first officer says, "No, I don't." And the captain says, "Well, I do. And I think this black hole bomb is a miracle. It's the miracle that's going to save humanity."
And I wrote down one of the,
and they kind of go back and forth.
Away from the mic now. I wrote down one of the miracles. The captain says, "That's a word God created for us just for this moment." And that's before the battle that wipes out a bunch of things. But, like, they keep coming back to the idea of miracles.
Yeah.
Which is, like, not... I feel like that's not a very heartening word for a military operation.
No, it removes the agency, but it's the people fighting the battle that are removing their own sense of agency by the use of the word miracle. And I think that is meant to illustrate, like, how... absolutely overwhelmed they feel by the prospect of what they're trying to do.
Oh, my favorite thing that the
captain says... Like, if this even works, it will be a miracle.
My favorite thing the captain says is... his badass fight line is, "We'll show you what mankind can do when backed into a corner."
Yeah.
It's not like, "We'll show you what mankind is capable of."
Yeah.
But I don't know. Like, I like how... like I said, there's something, like... humbled about this speech. Okay, please now go into
explanation
about the science.
There's no science. So they successfully get to the point where the bomb is about to go off, but then the bomb does not go off because it has sustained just enough damage to not allow its internal reactors to cross the threshold for detonation. So it doesn't go off and all is lost.
They're like, "Well, I guess we failed."
And then Noriko says, "No, we didn't. Gunbuster has its own degeneracy reactor. I will fly in with my buster unit and set it off myself." And then Amano says, "No, you won't. I will go with you. We will join Gunbuster. We will join our Buster machines."
You know what's better than one degenerate series?
Two. And if we both go, then we will use the remaining reactor to escape the explosion so that we don't die in it.
I think before Amano joins her, the captain is like, I guess the miracle didn't happen. And Noriko goes like, I will make
the miracle happen. Yes. Which is a very Noriko line.
Noriko's a fucking badass.
Yeah, she is.
Like a well-earned badassery. And then they are... Oh, it's also like... In the control room, there's also talk of like, oh, I guess the next wave of space monsters will be about 12 billion.
Yeah.
And it's clear that like, if whatever Noriko is trying to do doesn't work, like...
They're all gonna die.
Like, this is just beyond anything that they can possibly hope to overcome. And they're... Again, I have trouble... I'm not saying that Gunbuster's using real science. I'm saying that I have less of a foothold in, like, science fiction as a genre to parse fake science as well as you can.
Okay.
So you're gonna also have to help describe, like... The Gunbuster descending into the area of Jupiter.
So Gunbuster sort of gains access to the interior of the black hole bomb, which is the interior of this giant planet-sized egg, it turns out, is actually like the core, like it is Jupiter compressed to, we are told, 1/30,000th of its original size, which doesn't make a huge amount of sense. But it's an enormous amount of matter compressed into a very dense...
Chibi Jupiter.
Stupider-chan is in this bomb. And, of course, the pressure inside there is extraordinarily high. And Gunbuster starts, like imploding and falling apart the further into the core they go.
And it's also, like, as it's descending, it's in its cool, like, arms crossed pose.
Oh, yeah, and it earlier it, like, takes off and flies with its arms crossed, and it's just extremely badass that the Gunbuster is a mech that flies around with its arms crossed. It's really good. So it descends, it lands on the surface of, like, the actual core, and...
Am I gonna start crying now?
I don't know.
Talk about this.
Well, so...
Maybe. I might... I started crying, like,
yes. So,
while we were watching.
Young Freud follows them in.
In the black, Sizzler Black.
In Sizzler Black, and is like, I'm going to go with you. And they're like, no, you're not. Sizzler Black will not be able to take the pressure. It's already imploding.
The glass in her cockpit starts cracking.
And she's like, I don't care. And it's like, okay, we know you don't, but you shouldn't do this.
But that's such a...
But then she says something that I never noticed before.
She says some stuff first. Hold on.
She being Young Freud.
Young Freud. No, I think the only thing I wrote down is the thing you're about to mention.
Right. So they have an argument and Young Freud doesn't want to let them go because it's a suicide mission. And they say, it's not a suicide mission. We're going to use the second degeneracy reactor to come out. And Young Freud then is the one that points out, yeah, but the time dilation involved means that it's gonna be a long time before you get back to Earth.
Yeah.
And they're like, well, we're still going and you can't come. And they talk her into it, but she says, well, when you get back, we're gonna say welcome home.
I'm gonna give you a big welcome
back. I'm gonna give you a big welcome home. And that is the first time I noticed that line, and in light of what happens later, it's rough.
I definitely started. I feel like I'm gonna start crying now.
Yeah. They get.
Is this okay that this is a podcast that people cry on?
Yes, it is.
Like.
So they land on the core and.
No, shush for a second.
Okay, go. I want to hear what you have to say. Actually.
I don't have to say anything particularly interesting. It's just like the. We've talked about kind of like the inability of Young Freud to like not have bravado in conversation.
Yeah.
This is like the. The most emotionally devastating version of like the bravado of Young Freud.
You're right, because she says so like
sad.
When you get back, I'm gonna say welcome. Like she says it. The phrasing is like, I'm gonna give you a big welcome home when you get back.
And as she's saying this, like, she's realizing she's never gonna
see. She's realizing she is like, even if they make it, even if everything goes perfectly from here on out, she is never going to see them again.
And as we talked about a little bit in the last episode, as much as, you know, like, Noriko and Amano are the main characters, but in this whole, like, clusterfuck of, like, time dilation tragedy, like, there is this third person who is in a similar place to them.
Yes.
Who doesn't really have anyone.
I mean, young Freud, for her part, has experienced nearly as much of the effects of time dilation as Noriko has.
And she's also in a more similar... She's ended up in a more similar situation.
And she's been piloting Gunbuster with Noriko for the past 6 months.
Like, where Amano, you know, found Coach. And I'm not sure exactly when Coach died, but Amano, you know, made her place as, like, the teacher for these high school girls. Young Freud kind of made the same decision of Noriko to be like, I don't really have a place that I belong in, aside from this... kind of like completely divorced
this war out of time,
like, space military operation.
Yeah.
And up until this point, like, Noriko was sort of her only peer. Then she sees, like, her other only oldest friend, and now she's losing both of them.
Yeah.
And it's all dawning on her at once, but she's still kind of this person that can't lose her shit.
I mean, she literally says, I won't say goodbye. She says, like, itarashai, like, which is the thing you say to someone in Japanese when they're going out to, like, run an errand, but you expect them to come back.
And either Amano, or I can't remember.
Amano says, itakimasu, which literally means, I will go and come back. And it's what you say in response to itarashai, is what you say when you are the one who is leaving the house.
And a minute later, we see her on the bridge of the atrium, just, like, sobbing.
Yeah.
And it's not something that she can do in front of her friends.
Yeah.
But I don't know. It just, like, it broke my heart, you know? I didn't dislike her. I always liked her the first time I watched, but this time I was just like, man,
no, I haven't
fucking, like, MVP.
Yeah, this rewatch of Gunbuster has made me just, like, want to write, like, novel length fanfic about young Freud's internal life and her feelings about future Soviet politics and the compromises she's made. And she is such a great character. So after me trying to jump the gun, I'm going to ask you to explain what happens next. So what happens next? They send young Freud away.
Yeah.
They get her to leave. And then what happens?
They continue their descent, and then it's clear to the both of them. I mean, it was clear to the both of them, but then they kind of have no one else around to acknowledge the truth of what they're doing.
Yeah.
And I think the music goes pretty silent for this part, and Noriko says something like, haha, there's no one else around aside from the two of us.
Yeah.
And Amano says, it's all right as long as I'm with you.
Yeah.
Which is very... That also fucked me up a bit. So then, like, do they descend, like, the surface of...
Like the core somehow.
The core of Mini Jupiter.
Yes.
Chibi Jupiter.
Yes.
And then they're at the point where they have to set off this bomb. And we're still in this setup that we saw in the last episode where Noriko has this kind of, like, floating...
She's, like, suspended in kind of a frame with, like, display... With like, a spherical display all around her so she can see all around her. And then Amano is in a much more, like, crammed with gadgets and readouts cockpit somewhere else in the machine.
Yeah, so Noriko says, like, dude, like, trust me with your life. It might have been something cooler than that. It must have been, like, please trust me with your life, like, Une-sama.
Yeah.
And I think that's another interesting thing in this episode, is that Noriko still calls her Une-sama.
Yeah.
You kind of get the sense that, like, Amano doesn't want to be called that anymore. Like, she just really wants to be on an equal footing as a friend. And then Noriko pulls out Gunbuster's heart, which is Gunbuster pulling out its own heart. So for Noriko, it's her, like, screaming, ripping her shirt open. For Gunbuster, it's, like, wrenching the front plate
of her. So Noriko gives a gigantic yawp and tears her shirt open such that a boob falls out.
The most emotional nip slip in anime history.
And then this, in turn, Gunbuster rips off its own chest armor, exposing its like rib cage. And then it plunges its hand through its chest and rips out its like its own heart, which is its one of its two degeneracy reactors. And then Noriko yells again and slams it into the core of Chibi Jupiter.
Noriko shouted, "I at the heart of the world."
Oh my god.
You say, "Oh my god," when you...
When I'm very impressed with something that you've said, yes. And this completes the chain reaction and takes the black hole bomb past the edge of criticality, and the black hole bomb detonates.
That's the alternate title for this episode, Past the Edge of Criticality.
And there's a great detail in here that I want to point out. It's just like a, maybe a less than a second of animation. So like, you know, Gunbuster sets the bomb off and then has to get away. And to get away, there's this moment of Gunbuster has tank treads on the bottom of its feet that we've seen several times before. And these tank treads like go into hard reverse, as we can almost picture like Amano just like slamming the throttle down and like they start spinning out and Gunbuster like zooms backward, trying to outpace the explosion as it sort of starts to go off. And it's such a cool like split second moment to show that they are actually trying not to die.
Jupiter Drift.
Oh my god.
Okay, so before we get to like what happens after that, I forgot to mention something entirely. In the very first scene, when Amano is visiting Koja's grave, preparing to leave.
Yes.
Takami, Kimiko's daughter, and her classmates give Amano like a token. I don't remember exactly what it is. It's like a wreath.
Yes.
That they made.
Yeah.
And it's in the Gunbuster cockpit. With Amano takes it with her.
Yes.
Like she looks at it.
Yeah.
During this operation.
Yeah.
And then also another thing that I thought was interesting was in the battle where just these like ginormous numbers are flying out.
Yeah.
Enemies and damages taken. The captain says something that they're like a type of ship that's fighting on humanity's side is called like the Super Excelion class.
Oh yes.
And it like for a show that's only six episodes, that was a tiny detail that made me feel one of many things where it's like you really feel like the entire passage of time in this show.
Yeah.
If that makes sense. I feel like I'm sounding like an idiot.
No. Like, they respect the fact, like, when they do a time skip, they respect the fact that there is continuity there.
But I feel like you as a person who's been following the characters that are sort of on the... who've been there for all of it, you feel like you've experienced, like, a half a lifetime of shit and technological developments.
Yeah.
And... yeah. It's your turn to plot recap.
And then the explosion goes off, and it's very large, and the fleet scrambles to get clear of it. And then we cut to Earth, and Kimiko is out with her daughter, and she, like, they're at the seaside or something.
Oh, before that happens, Noriko... she's like to herself.
Yeah.
The cockpit says, she starts crying.
Yeah.
And she says, I'm sorry, Kimiko. I'm never going to
see you again. I'm sorry, Kimiko. I'm never going to see you again. And then we cut, then the bomb goes off. And then we cut to Kimiko, who's looks up at the sky and says, and then her daughter says, what is it, mom? And her, and she says, I thought I heard Noriko.
Yeah.
And it's probably nothing. And then things seem to happen very quickly, although it truly isn't actually that clear how quickly they happen. We see the Milky Way in a long shot, and the core gradually just collapsing in on itself and fading to black as, like, you know, millions of stars are devoured by the black hole bomb. And it's very quiet, and the music is very mournful. And then we're back in the remains of the Gunbuster with Noriko and Amano, and they have arrived at Earth, but they don't know. Oh, then there's a caption.
They do know.
Then there's a caption. 12,000 years later.
They still have a clock.
They still have a clock.
And it's like 14,000 something something, yes. AD.
12,000 years later. But subjectively, the next instant, Noriko and Amano arrive in Earth orbit, and they're looking at the Earth, and it's still there. And they're very happy, but there's nothing on it. They can't see any lights, and they're on the night side.
There's this moment of despair.
It's like, did we fail? Is no one left? Because Earth is dark. And then gradually the lights on the surface of the planet start to come on. I can never get through this moment without crying.
As it should be.
And the lights in katakana, they spell out Okaeri Nasai. Like a whole city. Whole cities lighting up. To spell welcome home. And the final E in Okaeri Nasai is backwards. And it makes it, and in that little piece of storytelling, you can tell that the written language that they, that Noriko and Amano speak has been forgotten and then rediscovered in time for them to spell this out for these two women having come home after 12,000 years. And it's one of the great final moments in all of cinema, as far as I'm concerned. And I can never describe it without breaking down crying. It always happens. Oh, God.
And this is the first time that either of us noticed that at some point in this, like, thousands and thousands of years trajectory, like, somebody carried on young Freud's wishes.
Right, like,
he gave a big welcome back.
Yeah. Like, young Freud literally says, when you get back, I'm gonna greet you with a big welcome home. And then they do. And it's so good. And I actually connected it, just this watching, to like a category of things in a type of like fictional plot development that will always, 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 always fuck me up. Which is when you think they forgot about you, but they didn't forget about you. That's the best. But Gunbuster does that on the scale of a civilization.
Yeah.
But it also makes it like deeply intimate and personal. It does that rare feat that is kind of only accessible to science fiction, which is making something simultaneously cosmic scale and also human scale. It's so fucking good.
Yeah. I'm sorry that me and Paul are just sitting across the table from each other crying.
It's just, whatever. Everybody knows that you can't describe the ending of Gunbuster without crying. This is famous.
Yeah. It's so good. I loved the show the first time I watched it. I love it more now. I noticed so many more things this time.
Yeah.
I think about that last episode all the time. Basically, as soon as the explosion dies down, like that piece of, from that, like through the end credits, is one of my favorite pieces of music, like in all of anime.
And I want to say, like, Gunbuster reuses music a lot, but God, the orchestral themes for this show are great. They're so good.
And the one at the end is like, even if we've heard the melody before, like it's still singular.
It's a different, the final, the end credits music that begins sort of as the final scenes are playing out is not reused. That's the only time we hear it in the series. And it's really good. It's got this kind of high-pitched sort of stately melody over the swelling chords beneath it, and it's just it's like somehow simultaneously like lonely but hopeful.
Yeah, I mean that's what this is. I'm sorry, we're really just losing our shit.
It's rough, man.
I hope that you're gonna lose your shit when you're watching this or will watch this. What was I gonna say? I think it's one of the most hopeful stories, at least in anime. And sometimes I feel like I'm pussying out when I'm like in anime. Uh-huh. What I really mean is in fiction.
Sure.
Like I'm a fucking weeb. When I say something's like the best in anime, I probably mean that it's like the best in fiction.
I'll go to the mat for Gunbuster as a great work of science fiction, like, period. Like I don't need to couch it in like, you know, medium relative terms.
Yeah. And it is one of the great stories about humanity prevailing not through bravado, partly through military force, but it's also like there's so much desperation in the show. And it's like a lot of the success that humanity ultimately found was through hope and sort of like people finding bravery beyond the limits that they thought they were capable
of.
And it's like, it's just this cosmic level, beautiful story, but it's also a beautiful story of these two characters who are like in their own ways, kind of completely isolated and abandoned from other people and time. Through all of this, after 12,000 years, being together, having gone through the same thing, prevailing together. And I don't, like, they've got to be one of the best, like, friendships in anime.
Yeah.
I was saying in anime.
And at the end of all of this, like, all you want for these characters is just some peace.
Yeah.
Like, I hope that when Noriko gets back to Earth, very little is asked of her ever again. Because she has given enough.
Yeah.
And I really do, like, it is a wonderful moment of friendship. But watching it this time, and particularly in light of like how I realized episode 5 reads upon a closer reading, like, Amano got an adulthood.
Yeah.
She got a marriage. She experienced some kind of like an emotional arc to her life. Noriko has been fundamentally alone since her father died.
Yeah, she's been, like, after 10 years, after 15 years, after 12,000 years, she's returning to Earth, and she's still physically, like, 18 or 19.
But she has been alone forever, She has no reason. At no point has she ever had any kind of really emotionally credible reason to make the kind of sacrifices that she makes.
Yeah.
But she makes them anyway.
Yeah.
And that's what really sticks to me at the end of this, is how little the world gave Noriko and how much she gave back to it.
Yeah. You're going to make me cry again. We're just going to keep crying. I think I don't know. Do you understand why I was so into, like, we have to watch Gunbuster again when yes. all of this happened?
Yes.
Because that was what it was all about, is a week or two into the national, for most people, quarantine. I was like, we have to watch Gunbuster again. We should do a podcast about it. It's not the same thing at all, of course. But it's what I turn to when I need a story about just, like, hope that exists beyond the point that it maybe should. And also a story of your contributions mattering and the difference you make mattering, even if you're doing it alone, which I think has been one of the hardest things about this crisis.
Yeah.
Is that for a lot of people, you wanna band together in a crisis. You wanna feel because of my weird fictional past. What my mind jumps to is you want that Les Mis, brotherhood, group thing.
Yeah, yeah.
We can't have that now. Doing our part means doing our part alone, and Gunbuster is kind of a very weird extreme example of that. Also, I had these fucking dorky visions that made me very emotional. We have these pictures of, city landmarks that are usually packed, being empty. And one morning I woke up and I was like, oh my God, I was just thinking of city landmarks, but with the Gunbuster, Okaidin aside. that would fuck me up.
Yeah.
But we are going to get the world back. I'm pretty sure. I'm not an expert, but...
And we'll be there to welcome each other home.
we're gonna give everyone a big welcome back.
It won't take 12,000 years, though.
No. Thanks for... joining us, putting up with us on this journey, but
さよならは言いません。行ってきます。